The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 27th of May, 2021. On the podcast today, Richard Hallahan, CEO of Polarian Imaging, discusses the article on hyperpolarized xenon by the Oxford Biomedical Research Center concerning a study carried out in longer-term lung damage after COVID-19. Also on the podcast, Vadim Alexander, head of healthcare at SP Angel, discusses the proposed reverse takeover of Motive Bio by Bivictrix Therapeutics. That's BVX, a biotech company applying a novel approach to develop safer, more effective cancer therapies. Also on the podcast, Dan Lane, senior analyst at Free Trade, discusses Synergen on the market, Cora Gold, Tremor International, and Warehouse REIT. Plus, Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talks about Team 17 and Bidstack. And at the end of the podcast, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs too. You can check out both these lists at foxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a wealth of content worth checking out. In fact, there's an article there on Ethinity Networks received 2 million in custom orders from Tirana. There's an article there on Trellis co-founder Marla Dubinsky discusses how Trellis helps empower patients. There's an article there on Belvoir. There's a Trader's Cafe with Zach Meir. He's in his cafe a lot. Trader's Cafe it is. So it's a bit different from a normal cafe, but he's talking about extract resources with Colin Bird. In fact, there's an article there in New Group. Tuple, article on Tuple. And COVID-19 index. Biggest riser today is Dev Clever Holdings. No, it's not. I lie. It's Symphony Environmental. Up 10% to 18.75. Biggest faller is Avacta Group, down 2.45% to 247. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Hallahan, Chief Executive Officer of Polarian Imaging. P-O-L-X is the ticker there. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you, as always, Justin.
Yeah, and we've had an interesting article out, and you've sent out an RNS on this. It's an article on hyperpolarized xenon, and of course it was by the Oxford Biomedical Research Center. So we sort of had an early sort of readout on these on this long COVID issue that couldn't be picked up, but we've had now further results. Could you explain what's happened here, what they've come up with, what they've found, please, Richard?
Yeah, so this is a kind of a great example of news turning into science, right? The news is always full of kind of preliminary results from somebody thinking that they see something somewhere, and then somehow you never see the article again because it didn't get through a peer-reviewed process and into scientific literature. Of course, you know from our backstory that we have 1,000 peer-reviewed journal articles in our library of things that we and our researchers and collaborators have done. But this is a great example of a well-designed, well-controlled study having been done by Dr. Gleason and co. at Oxford, making its way through the peer review process into what is one of the most important journals in medical imaging, and that's radiology.
Yeah. So that's quite significant. Because I often hear, I mean, of course, I'm a lay person. I know nothing about how this works. But so this has been published and also peer reviewed, and obviously in a big, well-respected publication, Radiology. So that's a big deal, isn't it?
It is, and I think you would know from observing our behavior that unless it's peer reviewed, you have not seen press releases or digital media stuff from us on the subject of COVID. I think it's fraught with peril to be publishing things that aren't peer-reviewed. So this is really important. And it is an early study. It's a small study, but I think it's really, really important. It has some key information in it about the use of hyperpolarized xenon in assessing these long-haul patients who, as is the case with most of COVID, these just hugely disparate responses that the human body has to this assault, and the fact that some people sail through with not too much effect, and other people have their lives devastated physiologically. And the question is, why? How? What happened? You know, and how do we help? How do we fix people? I mean, the point of all this is, of course, inevitably leads in the direction of helping physicians, clinicians, and pharma diagnose and deliver therapeutic benefits to these patients. But you can't do that if you don't know what's happened, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you haven't got the right... I mean, just to summarize there what Professor Gleason said, he said many COVID-19 patients are still experiencing breathlessness several months after being discharged from hospital, despite their CT scans indicating that their lungs are functioning normally. Our follow-up scans using high-polarized xenon MRI found the abnormalities not normally visible on regular scans are indeed present, and these abnormalities are preventing oxygen getting into the bloodstream as it should in all parts of the lungs. So that's massive, because you think this, the current standard can't pick up these issues. Yeah. And, you know, COVID is a massive issue. We haven't had a pandemic for 100 years, so it's huge, isn't it, really?
I think it is, and it's part of this story that we've been trying to explain all along, which is there's a difference between looking at the structure of a thing and trying to assess its function. And so, until the kind of mid-70s, the most ubiquitous exam on the planet was the chest X-ray, which was fabulous at kind of explaining the structure of the thoracic cavity, but not much about function. And then CT took its place with a much higher resolution assessment of structure, but still not function. And so finally, we're able to help MR become the useful tool that it is in much of the rest of medicine with respect to explaining how tissue is functioning. So this is important.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned last interview, you're often in contact. I mean, we're just over 4 months away from that FDA approval date. But you mentioned you're often in contact with the FDA. So would this kind of research and the results of study be passed on to them?
They are aware of it. We are in constant contact with them. I think everyone knows that the FDA has the right in the context of the review of a submission to request things like orientation meetings and updates. And so we do that. They know how far that we have pushed the technology since we began speaking to them. And in fact, although it's not part of our submission, they are aware of this research and the outcomes that we're seeing. But by definition and of necessity, the submission is constrained to its original agreed structure, content, and framework, which was set several years ago before all this began. But they know what we're doing, and they actually do know about this.
Yeah, absolutely. A question here from Sheila. Is your technology compatible with all MRI manufacturers?
Yeah, we have deployed our systems on GE Siemens and Philips scanners. All is a big word, and there are lots of new folks coming into the market, particularly from Asia. And so we do not know those folks as well. We'll get there in due course, I'm sure, as we encounter folks who want to do research on them in the U.S., but we have not yet.
But GE, Siemens, and Philips, they're the biggest, aren't they?
Yeah, of course. You know, the world's installed base is the cumulative sum of everything that's been done. And so when you kind of plot the curves there by weight or by volume, the bulk of the world's installed base are those. There are a lot of machines.
Yeah, yeah. And is it okay to assume that, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard anyway to be compatible with others? I assume the systems are quite similar, aren't they?
Yeah, it's really just, kind of product engineering. There are certain things that have to be done to get MR machines to image things other than protons, which is what they do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. All of the big guys have sorted that all out long ago. They have catalog items in their price books that are FDA approved that enable this, or in some cases simply software settings that turn it on. But yep, it's very well understood. It's the foundation of MR. Magnetic resonance imaging is derived from nuclear magnetic resonance, which is where all this started, which is using MR techniques to evaluate chemistry or all nuclei that can be visible in MR.
Yeah, yeah. I've had this question pop up quite a few times, and it's a good problem to have. It's from a shareholder worrying that you'll be taken out too early. Now, this is they have no control of this, a small shareholder, of course. But, I mean, the question was, I don't know what you can answer here, is if after FDA approval, if that happens, of course, and you get approached as a takeover, you get an offer, would the board go for a quick exit, or would you prefer to go on the commercial route?
I think we are equipped and structured to go to market and grow this business as a standalone company, and very happy, all of us who do it, very happy to be doing that. In the end, you know, those kinds of things, be they hypothetical or otherwise, are determined by shareholders. And one of the things that has happened, as you would know, over the last several raises is our share register is now full of some pretty big funds who hold large pieces of the company. So those things can only happen with shareholder votes. Mm. And we think we know what shareholders want to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're planning on doing this ourselves.
Yeah, excellent stuff. That's good news. During a recent video I did, I just extrapolated some of the numbers on MRI scans, just doing 10% of the world, pretty much, you know, MRI scans. And the numbers come out massive, huge. In fact, almost, I even said at the time, this looks too silly to put out there, but I'll put it out there. And but do you, you know, I mean, you've been quite conservative, and of course there are research notes out there, but how do you, in your head, do you ever think how big this could get, realistically?
Well, I think there are, for us, there are kind of two big components in our picture frame of the picture that we're making here. One is the global installed base of hospitals and MR machines. And the other is the global prevalence of pulmonary disease. Mm-hmm. And so anyone can do the arithmetic. It's, you know, approaching billions of patients with pulmonary dysfunction, and they're assisting their clinicians with trying to evaluate their dysfunction and their therapeutic regimes over time. And again, we know that we would be treating them over their entire lifetimes, because at least as present and as best we understand it, these folks are not going to be cured. They're going to live with these diseases. And then the world continues to build hospitals and build MR machines. So the number is quite large. I think the existing research, in keeping with our kind of culture and our method of approaching investors, very conservative since the outset, right? We don't overstate, we don't kind of hyperbolize this. We do the arithmetic. It's right there in black and white for anybody to calculate, and it could be quite large.
Yeah, yeah. No. I mean, what I did, went through the other figures, and I almost had to sort of blink a couple of times again, really? But the possibility is there, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, it is. Mm. I think there are likely to be waves of these things. All of these new technologies start in the high end of academic medicine and work their way down, much the same way that MR did. There are very expensive multi-million-dollar 7 Tesla MRI machines. And then there are machines that are better for use in smaller institutions with smaller budgets. Those things took years to unfold. Entirely possible our roadmap looks in a similar fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Another question there, and you sort of mentioned this previously, but are there other areas of medicine your technology is applicable to outside of pulmonary?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think we know, and there are being published in peer-reviewed journals, so back to the important aspects of that, but there are people applying the technology to other body parts and organ systems, trying to assess its possible utility. We'll see how that goes. I mean, this business of oxygen getting to places where it needs to go is what this technology is all about. And in theory, every organ system, the body, it needs that understanding because it's key to organ function. So perhaps any of those things unfold in that way. We'll see. Right now, our focus is pulmonary. It is intense. We need to get this done and finished, and then we can look around and see what may or may not come next.
Excellent stuff, Richard. It's always good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time, Justin. Have a good day.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexander, Head of Healthcare at SP Angel. Wow. Where have you been, Vadim? What's happened?
How are you doing, Justin? We've been working hard on, there's a few deals we got done. So that's unfortunately, sorry for not being on the podcast for
that's
a couple
weeks. Well, people have missed you, you know. They said, where's Vadim? I said, well, I don't know. It's kind of, and someone said, can you get him on the weekly webinar on your share pickers? I said, I can hardly get him on the podcast, let alone that. So anyway, listen, so eTherapeutics was one of the deals we talked about, most recently I got an email about this, but Motive Bio proposed reverse takeover. So,
correct. Motive
Bio was very popular in the day, and I had Graham on the podcast many a time, and they were doing Iclaprim, wasn't they? It was an antibiotic, but I don't know why. At one point, I got out. I think it rose towards this news. I got out. I don't know why I did, and I dodged a bullet
I didn't.
Steve, a mate of mine on the weekend podcast, held them, and they dropped off a cliff. I said, why didn't you get out? And he just kept holding them. I think he probably still holds shares in them now, which I think he's given up for the ghost in them. But there may be a bit of hope for some people if you've given up completely on the shares, there may be some value there, mightn't there?
Yeah, well, so, you know, okay, a couple of things. When Motif, obviously, you ran into an FDA that... what do you call it? The decision that went the wrong way, right? Yeah. So they got a CRL.
Well, phase three, wasn't it? Was it phase three?
Yeah. I mean, it was submitted to the FDA, right? So this was on their drug, their lead drug, Iclaprim. Yeah. It obviously went the wrong way. Shares collapsed. I was a shareholder myself at the time. You know, it's painful, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure most people don't want to remember that too much. You know, we lost, I can't even remember, whatever it was, 70, 80% in one day, right, from market close to market open. Yeah. But, you know, that is probably the worst type of risk that you run, when something goes wrong at the very end, right? Because this is submitted to the FDA. And anyways, so look, that's the history of Motif. It was an antibiotic. The company then converted into a shell, which is known as a real 15 cash shell, and then was looking for an asset to buy, so a company to reverse into it. Okay, so that's what was announced yesterday. So after a long search and multiple different assets I know firsthand a lot of different companies and assets were looked at. They came to a company here in the UK. It's a company called Bivitrix. And there was a perfect match, basically. I mean, this company is something I'm quite excited about. I'm participating in the placing. You know, it's historically Motif had still a carry, so there is still a carry in Iclaprim. You know, but unfortunately, as you might imagine, it's, you know, once you turn into a they still have a carry. So the cash shell still exists. The cash shell still had a carry in the asset, and that asset is now. Being marketed by a third party. So if ever that comes to something, then Motif shareholders still have carry and all that. Mm. However, really, once you turn into a cash shell, it's all about the future business that reverses into you, right?
Yeah.
And this business is one, you know, I've had a long time to look at myself. I find it really, it's quite an interesting and exciting future that I think, you know, not only Motif shareholders, but new shareholders coming in have. Let me tell you about the business.
Explain this to me. So it says, Bivitrix, a UK-based antibody drug conjugate discovery and development company. Yeah, please unfold that for me. What does that mean?
Yeah, perfect. So to keep it simple, what they do is they develop an antibody, that has, it's called a bispecific antibody. So it targets two antigens instead of one. Normally, an antibody targets one antigen. Okay, a bispecific, kind of as the name describes it, targets two antigens. Okay, that's the major innovation here. Is it targets two antigens on the cancer cell that it's targeting instead of one, giving it a much higher level of specificity. Mm-hmm. The antibody then kills the cancer cell once it hits its target. It has a payload. It's called an antibody drug conjugate. So it has a drug that's that has a cell kill drug attached to it. So mm-hmm. once it hits its antigen targets, we call it an antigen fingerprint. So two antigens. Only when it hits the two antigens will it kill the cell. And that's what's innovative here. It's pretty much not been done before. And that's why there was a lot of interest. I mean, we ended up raising, I think, just over £10 million. It's really well supported. It was heavily oversubscribed. That as far as reverses go, I think, for that shell, it's quite a good outcome. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the valuation was good too. So I'd like to think that as an oversubscribed placing at a good valuation, we hope to see good trading in the aftermarket.
Yeah, well. So where are they at the moment, development wise? What stage are they at in their clinical studies, preclinical? What are they at this company?
Yeah, so this is a fairly early stage company. So it's a preclinical stage company. Yeah. However, it's in the area that they're targeting is acute myeloid leukemia. And there are big deals being done preclinically in this space. I mean, both preclinically and early phase clinical trials, so phase 1, 2, we're talking $100 million deals or in some cases $1 billion deals. So the main point is that this company doesn't need to go that far to create significant value. I think the post deal market cap is going to be some sub 20, so something like 16, 17 million. So you can see the value opportunity here. There's several companies. I'll give you another. So the broader area is antibody drug conjugates. So they're called ADCs. Okay, there was just a company not long ago in Scandinavia called ADC Endo that did a Series A financing. So as the round describes, it's like one of the first rounds of financing, and they raised 55 million euros. Wow. Okay, so you can imagine that what the valuation wasn't actually disclosed at the time. But my main point is that's just one example. There are many, many examples of early stage ADC companies or companies targeting AML that are doing very, very well, in terms of valuation. So I hope that people will do well out of this because the value is right. The in price is right. The area is really hot. And, the strategy is very innovative. So it wouldn't surprise me. I know they've been approached, by VC funds, but they chose the listed route because it just allows them to immediately kick off their programs. And the problem with VC funds is it takes a very long time to convert them. They do their due diligence for months and months. So here is an opportunity for both Motif shareholders to, turn the page and, see value creation out of a new company that is quite, that's not a new company, but via a new company reversing into them. And then by the same token, it allows Bivitrix to have access to public markets, which, not only gives them capital, and they raised, like I said, 10 million, they raised substantially more, but took 10 million. And also the exposure, which is exactly where they should be. Yeah. So it's an exciting opportunity. I think it'll do good by both existing and new shareholders.
Yeah, but look at the shareholders here. The significant shareholders above 3%. The biggest one is Development Bank of Wales at 14.25%. So, and second is Canaccord Genuity. Third is Robert Keith. Robert Keith has done very well from tech companies. He's very little known. He keeps his head above. But Charles Street is his. Charles Street Holdings is his company. But he's
a great investor. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree with you. And. So a couple of things, on that. So you've got the backing of some pretty people who are in the know, so that's good. The second thing is Development Bank of Wales was a shareholder previously to the business.
Okay.
So they're backing it further. So you've got a supportive shareholder putting more money in. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix of things. You have a lot of existing shareholders supporting the existing business. You have new shareholders coming on stream. They've raised a substantial amount of capital for a business at this stage. All the kind of, the arrows point in the right direction. The board is very strong too. That's the other thing for people to have a look at is, you know, Ian Ross is the chairman, and he's the chairman of several other AIM companies, let alone he was on Silence Therapeutics, which is, I think, a 10-bagger in and of itself. He was involved in eTherapeutics in the past. You know, and he's basically a serial AIM chairman of success stories. Other people on the board just worth looking at is a chap called Bob Hawkins, who just floated his own. He was the founder of another business, another biotech company, that he just floated for $3 billion on NASDAQ, literally 2 months ago. You know, so this business is attracting some pretty seasoned veterans in the space, and there's got to be a reason for that. You know, they're putting their name to something that's quite quite interesting.
So do we know yet? Have they announced the next big sort of news milestone, next big sort of trial, or what's happening yet, or not?
Yeah, so now they deploy the capital for the first, you know, 12 months. The beauty of this is that, you know, the work can be done fairly quickly. I mean, it's not a week's work, but we're talking, you know, quarters as opposed to decades. The idea is over the next 3 years to create a lead molecule, okay, which they have, and to develop it, to get it to clinic, so clinic ready, okay? At that stage, you'd be looking at hopefully partnering it to advance it further. That's one that, well, unless obviously at that time the cost of capital makes sense for them to take it themselves, that's another. But in broad brush strokes, they have one fingerprint that they're targeting, and I can give you more detail on that. So what they're doing is they're targeting a particular antigen on the cancer cell, on the blood cancer cell, which is a known target. Okay, it's called CD33, and that target is already being used by an existing drug. So we know the target works. We know that ADCs work. So bringing a payload, hitting that antigen, kills the cell. And this is a drug called Mylotarg. It's a Pfizer drug. So it's out there. There's a drug out there targeting one of the two antigens. The problem with that drug is because it's non-specificity beyond that. So that antigen exists on healthy cells as well. So when you target, you kill the cancer cell, but you also hit healthy cells and it causes collateral damage, if you like. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're hitting that target, but they're giving it that additional bit that I was saying earlier, the second antigen, which is far more specific to only the cancer cell. And it gives you that much cleaner hit of hitting only the cancer cells and less the collateral damage of the healthy cells. So we are dealing with something that we know a lot about. We know a lot about these antibody drug conjugate ADCs. Mm-hmm. The CEO, Tiffany Thorne, that's her whole background. She knows how to make ADCs. So basically, you're developing you know how to develop ADCs. You know your target works. Now you're making an incremental step of making your target far more specific by hitting a second target on the same cell. And that's innovative. There really is very, very few people that have done that. So that's what's so interesting about this.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, keep an eye on them. What's going to be the ticker? Is it BVX, is it?
Yeah, it's going to be BVX, exactly. BVX.L.
Cool. Marvelous stuff. Thanks for the information there, and it's very interesting. And the market cap is suggested around about 16 million, is that right?
$16.5 million all in. You know, Motif shareholders originally were about one, so it's about one-tenth of the pre-money and then the new money that comes in. So that gives you a kind of an idea. I think the way to look at this story is from this valuation level, you know what I mean? Which it's good value. Motif struck a really good deal in buying this company at this level, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a very good deal for Motif shareholders. But the real value is if you look at the peers, it's really worth looking at the peers in this market, in this space, mm-hmm. is that, you know, seeing an uplift of 3 to 4 times on a 12 to 18 month, you know, is absolutely possible. You even look at AIM peers. I mean, you and I have talked about many, many. This is exactly the type of area that you see, you know, you could see significant uplift on early news flow. And then the longer play, so call it the 3-year view play. So I'm talking, you know, trying to split this in terms of the 6 to 12 month view. Mm-hmm. You could see a significant uplift. But then the 3-year play is where you see if you strike a collaboration agreement on a 3-year time frame, and that is their anticipation. They anticipate doing so, either for the lead asset or for several other fingerprints that they have. So they have other twin antigen fingerprints in their pipeline as well. Mm-hmm. But whichever way they do it, you know, then we're talking significant uplifts. You know, the peers that I'm talking about are, you know, hundreds of millions type valuation. Yeah. So that's there's two ways of playing this, right? You can play it on the short to medium term where you expect, you know, the early news flow uplift, but then you're looking at the bigger lottery. Anyways, let's get through the first uplift and see where we are, and we'll discuss it further on future podcasts. But my hope is this is a two stage, you know, first uplift and then second uplift is kind of like a carry for the big lottery.
Yeah, cool. And admission and commencement dealing in large share capital, they admitted to AIM based on the 15th of June. So that's when they'll start trading in the market. There. So, if you want to get access to them, it's a good time then. Marvellous stuff. Vadim, thanks. Fella, thanks for the heads up there and lots of info there. Plenty of time to do your research, everyone, before it lists. So, and that's a good one. You said it's not, it doesn't seem very expensive. $10 million in cash for the raised, and they got $60 million valuation. Wow, it's decent there. Marvellous stuff. Vadim, thanks for that. And we'll speak to you next week.
Excellent. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dan Lane, Senior Analyst at Free Trade. You're right, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Yeah, and just a quick reminder, Free Trade, for people not familiar, give us a brief summary of what it's about, Dan, if you could.
Yeah, we're an investing platform. We're app-based, and we do have a site, but we think it's quite easy for people to use our app. We're a commission-free platform. We don't like these big fees that some of the incumbents have been charging, so we simply just don't do it. So it's an easy way to get into simple investing in shares, ETFs, and investment trusts.
So how do you make money, then, if you don't charge anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Transparently, we put a 0.45 levy on U.S. shares. About 50% of our client base buys U.S. shares, so that's helpful for us. And we also have a subscription fee, so £3 for an ISA, £10 for a SIP every month. So, it's flat pricing helps people.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah, because you know what? I'm with Barclays, and I never know what they charge for. I mean, I'm happy with the dealing fees. It's fine, and their platform's quite good. I quite like that. But I get these charges. I thought, what? I didn't realize I was going to charge that. So I'm never quite sure how it works. And they do like this percentage of what you own and all that stuff. And so, like I said, it's not transparent. Flat fees do help. Okay, yeah. So...
We think Clear is really good.
Yeah. So I sent through an email and said, what are we talking about this week? And you mentioned a couple of stocks, quite a few stocks, actually. First one annoys the heck out of me because Synergin are based in Southampton Hospital. My son has a lung condition, and we've been into Southampton Hospital a lot. And I've read about them previously. I thought, maybe we should just invest in those because they're local, and my son's got a lung condition. You know, we've got some affiliation with that. And it's one of the reasons I've invested in Polarian Imaging, which has done very well, and I think will continue to do well. But I didn't take any stock in Synergin, and that was, and I've been talking about this for years. In fact, a guy on the podcast, Alan, mentioned them a while back, and Vadim Alexander from Head of Healthcare mentioned them, and we've been talking about them for years, and I never took a position, and all of a sudden they went from 34 pence to 225 in pretty much a day. I thought, what the heck? Oh, no. There's always those ones, isn't it? The ones you're scared of missing out on. But so what's the news from... I mean, it's come back a bit since then. It just in one day, it shot... I mean, let me just look at the bar chart here. This was the news on their COVID, I think, stuff, wasn't it? But it went up by 420% in one day.
Yeah.
That was in July last year, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was obviously that initial rise, and a lot of people will have missed out because it was just a complete, you know, if you're in there, you're probably a very niche investor anyway. But I mean, this week, what we have is, it's kind of a reversal of the recent narrative around these companies. If you look at the Novacyt as well as being this heavy trade because they both serve specific, you know, COVID strains, which was a shot in the dark for a lot of investors, but they've done very well so far. Yeah. I think they've fallen off because everyone said, okay, well, that trade's done with. You know, we're not going to get another pandemic. But I think it's interesting because Synergen, they've just got a drug there that it looks to be effective against the variants as well. So, you know, everyone had their one foot out the door, and then they said, you know, we've got these variants, and then Synergen said, well, let's see what we can do there. And it seemed to be positive. So there might just be a second bite at the cherry. We don't know, obviously, in terms of share price. Maybe that's baked in. It would be difficult to justify another 400% rise. But, maybe this is a little bit of a longer trade than people thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what I thought the other day? I mean, the human ingenuity and the advancement of science and technology during this pandemic has been phenomenal, really astounding, and you know, awesome, awe-inspiring. And I thought we should now be better prepared for anything else in the future, because just the amount of testing companies that have, you know, come up with very efficient testing technology, you know, within months, and so hopefully, if some more investment goes into this, we don't just forget about it, because when you realise the cost, how much it's cost the global economy, hopefully, you know, all the governments will get together and say it's worth putting some money aside every year to research, you know, highly about new pandemics or potential pandemics. And yet, I just think the technology, from vaccinations to testing, has shot ahead so much. It's almost like a race for space. When they started to go to space, all these, you know, spin-off technologies started coming out, you know, and I think that's where we are now. So I think we're better placed to deal with the future pandemic than we ever were, because, you know, like I said, it's amazing. Normally, vaccinations take 10 years, and they did it in 10 months. That's phenomenal, isn't it, you know?
Absolutely. And you know what? I think it really underlines the case for diversification among these kind of small spin-offs as well, because the opportunity can really arise before you've even had a look at them. Mm-hmm. So if you can afford to have a little bit of your portfolio, you know, exposed to these companies with promising assets, you're better doing it whenever, you know, tiling the roof when the sun's shining, you know, that old phrase, and being exposed before anything happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, so the next one you've mentioned there is On The Market. I did a hold On The Market, and I like the new guy. He's getting out there. He's signing up a lot of... I don't know if you look at Jason Tebb, the new CEO. He's been on the podcast. He's probably going again very soon, hopefully. But if you look at his and On The Market's Twitter feed, they're signing up a lot of agents, and he's engaging with a lot of them. And apparently that was the problem with... You know, Rightmove, the market dominant, the main dog, the big dog there, which is they would charge the agents a lot of money, very little engagement with them. And now I think Jason, the new CEO, is trying to be, you know, his best to engage and say, it's your platform, because you know, I think 65% of the stock is held by agents. It's your platform. Tell us what you want. How can we improve it? And he's sort of doing that, I think, you know?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It seemed, I mean, the news this week, they've just signed a year-long partnership with Canopy. They're a tenant referencing platform. Mm. And, you know, Jason came out and said, you know, it's a direct result of feedback from the agents. And I think, you know, everyone looks at Rightmove. If you look at the likes of, you know, Fundsmith and kind of the Smiths and Investment Trust, they've been kind of very, very bullish on Rightmove. But really, there's opportunity further down the cap scale. And I think On The Market is a good example of that. And getting it right this time is good. I mean, I think Purple Bricks ran into trouble because they took their eye off the community aspect of what they were trying to portray and run. I think the money maybe got ahead of them there. On The Market seems to be, you know, getting back to basics. What do you want? Let's build it. You know, and you can't really go wrong with that type of model.
Yeah. And do you know what? The only company last year to have, I mean, the portals have growth. They grew by over 20-odd% revenue-wise, top line. And that's considering they gave a lot of discounts to to agents and all that stuff. So they got growth there. And if you look at their revenue multiple compared to Rightmove, I know Rightmove is the main sort of the top dog, the market leader. But I think Rightmove is something like 20 times revenue they're valued on, whereas On The Market is basically three times. So there's plenty of gap to be made up there, you know. And there's potential there. Cool. On The Market, Marvel stuff. Cora Gold is one I held also a while back, but I've long fallen out of love with resource stocks. I like tech. It's got the stage where, as an investor, genuinely, I'm now looking at businesses and thinking, do I want to be an investor in the business? Do I want to hold a share of this business? Not the share price. Or how much can I make from the share price, but the business, you know? And I'm more interested in tech companies, British tech companies pretty much, or with a tech bias or in some way in that area, than I am in resource stocks. But I did like Cora Gold, and, you know, good story and some good backers there. What news have they had this week, Dan?
Yeah, so, they're doing some more drilling here, and they seem to be quite positive on this. I think what they're saying is that where they've been drilling is it's kind of been limited drilling there historically. And I think, you know, going back to what you're saying about resource companies, especially on AIM, they tend to take up fields, especially if you look at oil and gas, but even mines, they tend to drill where someone else has drilled and left it for maybe, you know, 20, 30 years, and they're going to come back in and kind of vulture over the whole thing. you have to accept that with resource stocks. They don't have the access to their own fields a lot of the time. They have to go scavenging. But really, when you're getting positive results, you can just tend to skim off the surface, and sometimes you get good results from that. But I take your point. There's a lot of risk in there. I think the point here is that in an A minor, if you're looking at an explorer, the risk is off the charts. If you're getting someone who's actually producing something, that risk is mitigated somewhat. And again, if we're starting to see this commodity super cycle chat come back, everyone seems to be thinking about, is gold this inflation hedge? Every day you're reading something different. But we're not looking at gold here. We're looking at the miner. And as you said, the miners often have high fixed costs. Anything above that turns into profit. So again, probably not going to be a core staple of anyone's portfolio. But if you're looking at something like Kora Gold, you're going to have to accept volatility. But when you get drilling results, they can really, really shake the price.
That's why most private investors starting off, start with resource companies, because you can make on news alone, they can rise massively. But you've got to be able to trade that and get out. It's not an investment in a vehicle because these kind of companies don't have cash. They're not generating cash, explorers. So the only cash they can get is from shareholders, essentially. So when a share price rises, liquidity, that was good news released, that is used to raise money, essentially. I mean, they have to survive to carry on with the exploring activities. So there's no real value generation there. There's news-driven, share price appreciation. And then that's why I've often said that, resource pop and drop stocks, because they'll pop on the news, and they'll have to do a fundraising later, and it'll drop, So you've got to be aware of that cycle, and because that's what happens. They're very volatile, but you can make money off them because the pops can be quite big, and they're going to last a while. It's not just one day. Sometimes they can last for weeks or months, but sooner or later, if they're not generating cash or real value, they tend to come back down to earth a little bit.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with buying in for a certain segment of a story. So, I like what they're doing here. Maybe, I like this certain section of this year period that they're going to do. There's nothing wrong getting out after that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to stay in for 20 years and, watch all that volatility. Never be able to.
No, exactly. Marv's, okay, what's next there? Tremor. And I've heard a bit about this, but I don't know too much about it. It's a bit too big for me, but what's happening there?
Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, they specialize in software aimed at the advertising market. It's kind of the digital marketing space. They've got some good results here. First quarter net revenue was up 96% to $63 million. Net revenues 105%. We're seeing a result of everyone saying that, okay, well, everyone's sitting at home during the pandemic. Let's pile money into the native or the digital advertising there. It's great, but you and I have spoken about the fact that all of these, by the time these results come out, it's inherently backward-looking. It'd be a brave person to say that digital advertising is on its way out, but we might have to get used to kind of a lower level, probably up on before the pandemic, but certainly lower than we're seeing now. As people start to get out, advertisers will naturally try and meet them on the tube or on the bus or in the taxi or somewhere other than on a computer screen.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, there's a couple of... There's still lots of areas around that you can look at that will benefit. And I've seen a couple of companies that, will benefit from the opening of trade and all that stuff that haven't been talked about previously. And connected to retail advertising, all that's going to rally. So worth looking at that. But, I've heard Tremor mentioned a few times. Worth a look at that because advertising is going to... Obviously, do what? Because during the pandemic, people just pulled their budgets, didn't they? They stopped spending completely overnight. But cool. Last one, Warehouse REIT. What's happening with that?
Yeah, so I threw this one in there. I thought this was interesting because the results are good here. They're not going to shoot the lights out. We've got 6 million on the budget in the final results. That's up from 30 million last year. So. We're not saying that this is gonna, this isn't another hot stock or anything. But what I thought was really important here is the fact that it's collected, 98.6% of its rental book over the year. Now, if you think about the whole commercial real estate sector, they were absolutely, crying out for rental yields and, renegotiating, with these flagship stores on Oxford Street in the commercial space. realistically, we might have to accept that real estate is changing and the value might be in these warehousing rather than, you know, these pretty stores on in the center of town. And I think a lot of these REITs, especially ones who don't have to stick to one sector, they're actually moving further out of town. Sometimes they're even building their own warehouses because they can see how valuable that is to the likes of Amazon trade. And they're realizing that even the ones who are running office blocks are thinking, will we really ever truly go back to work in the same way that we did? But just, you know, even things like, I mean, the whole point here is that we shouldn't just think of real estate as that flagship store on in the center of town. And I think, you know, if you look at some, there's a real estate investment trust called Civitas Social Housing. They collected their full rental book during the year because, you know, you'll still pay your rent. If you're going to live somewhere, you still pay your rent.
Yeah.
And I think we have to change the way we think about capital appreciation and really focus on the rental income in these REITs.
Yeah. So worth a look at. How big is that then? Warehouse REIT. It's around about 340 million market cap. Okay, cool. WHR is ticker there. Marvellous stuff. And are you looking at anything yourself, Dan? You know, anything catching your eye? Do you bother with the crypto yourself or not?
It's funny. I actually spoke to the MD for Europe for Coinbase, the platform, yesterday, and I had a good discussion around the fact that we don't need to wait for kind of this high volatility to die down to consider these things currencies. If we just ignore the speculation part and actually look to the current to the cryptos offering use cases right now, that's kind of what I'm interested in, because there's something that I can get hold of and understand there rather than just speculation. So I mean, obviously we're not tipping anything, but I, you know, one of the remittance services you and I were speaking about, actually Telcoin, it's trying to look to unseat Western Union as like the world's remittance service of choice.
I don't know if you can mention that, but Meteos did very well on those, and I literally fell off my seat when he told me that. So phenomenal return.
Yeah, I mean, we can obviously not advocate that it would do anything. After this, people might look at the charts and think, my word. Yeah. But past performance is no guide to future returns and all that. Mm-hmm. But yes, the use cases, regardless of the monetary side of things, that's really interesting at the minute.
Yeah, marvelous stuff. Dan, thanks, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. Hello, Al.
Good morning, Just. Fantastic sunny day here in Seaford, and I think we're going to have a hot bank holiday weekend.
Yeah, it's turned. Well, do you know what? I'm away. We're just going down the coast, not far. I can travel back if you like, if I want to. But we just booked this week off a while back, because when locked in, we couldn't travel abroad, of course. And we thought, the weather last week and this, you know, the week before, it's been raining nonstop in May, pretty much. It's probably one of the wettest Mays. We're going to spend time, you know, in Britain on holidays in a couple of weeks' time. And literally, it's turned. The first day of the day, I went and walked the dog this morning. It was actually warm, you know, in the morning. I didn't have to. I put on a body warmer and a hat and stuff, but I didn't need it. It was like really warm. And I think now, summer is starting to come. And I think, and pardon me, I don't know about you, but I still feel we're not really fully open. Maybe it's my lifestyle, the economy. Maybe it hasn't changed a lot since before the pandemic. So I haven't noticed a lot of difference, but I mean, maybe I wouldn't. But I feel now, with the sun coming out, maybe we'll be a bit more open. People outside, get outside a bit, you know?
Yeah, well, I went to London last week and met some people I haven't seen literally since the beginning of last year, and I haven't met up to London. And it was just great to get up there and just, touch base with people. Wasn't that busy, you know, the train was half empty, but certainly, based on what the people I saw said, it was a lot busier than it had been, and things seem to be coming back to life. But, I think it does feel like we're kind of emerging, blinking into the sunlight. But there is a major sea change down here for me, and today, for the first time, I've actually put shorts on. And
God, because normally you're naked, aren't you?
I am.
Odd you've dressed up a bit.
I normally do, yeah.
The thing is, when you go to the shops, you know, in your naturist fashion, and you get worn so many times, and you have to put a pair of shorts on sooner or later.
Yeah,
otherwise, you know, it's either your freedom or other people's freedom. You know, so yeah, there we are. So
well, this is it. But you know, if you look at hashtag naked podcasting, it is trending at the moment. So So I thought I was blazing trail, but no, I put shorts on today, and the family are pleased and well delighted. In fact, they are. Yeah,
they've left the house. Yeah. Right. Okay. Marvelous. Let's go into some stocks. So what's up first?
Okay, so we have spoken about this company on a number of occasions, but I mean, this company just continues to blaze a trail, and it's a British gaming company, British technology company, and for investors over the past few years. I mean, we looking back at August 2018, the shares were trading at under £2, and here we are today, they're trading at £7.23. Hit a high of they've hit a year high. Have £9. This is, of course, Team 17, TM17 is the epic code, and they are kind of an indie game. Well, they're a video games developer for indie labels, and they'll basically work with the developer to build the game up, develop it, get it ready, and obviously they've got a huge distribution network that they utilize for that. And they have hundreds of well-known titles, Worms, Overcooked, Escapist, Genesis Alpha, and so on. And we had an update from the group on the 16th of March this year with the unaudited final results of the full year to December, which was just yet more evidence of the company blazing its trail. And I think if you look back, I mean, a lot of companies in the tech space, particularly gaming, have seen growth during lockdown because, of course, people have been sitting in front of their computers and gaming devices and playing more games. But even so, the financial performances in the years prior to that are still hugely impressive. And I think that's what's so great about this company. It just continues to blaze a trail. So we had the numbers. The company said that during last year they released more titles than any previous year, which helped them to deliver revenue growth of 34%, and that's revenues up to 83 million on the year. Profits, pre-tax profits, 36% higher at 26.2 million. EPS growth, earnings per share growth of 32%. So, continual growth. And then, of course, what's really given this company strength in the marketplace is it has no debt. It just has a huge cash pile. And, of course, it uses that cash pile to make selective acquisitions and build its arsenal of gaming titles. So cash at the bank basically rose 47% to 61 million. So the company is well placed to make future acquisitions as we go forward. And again, you know, Debbie Bestwick just said that Team 17 family pulled together in a very challenging 12 months, and they've got a brand new range of titles that they're going to be launching this year. I won't read out all the titles. You can actually see this if you go to the announcement from March the 16th. But there are a ton of new titles ready to go, and it looks already as though the company is set up to deliver the same levels of growth in the current year that they did previously. Just a great investment, and you know, the shares have come off a bit from those year highs. I mentioned sort of £9 intraday high, currently trading at £7.23. But if you look at the chart, it's just a great company, and I think it's set to deliver more and more growth ongoing.
Fair play to Debbie Bestwick, MBE. Oh, Debbie, come stand forward. Debbie, you're doing a fantastic job of that little gaming company up there. Lovely. It was smashing great.
Absolutely
great. Look at the growth there. It's excellent. Double-digit stuff. I mean, on their results here, they've got, you know, revenue up 34% to 83 million, like I say. Gross profit up 33%. It's all that. Profit up 33%. Cash equivalents up 47%. So the cash is going up, the profit's going up. I mean, listen, this is a growing company and you pay a high multiple. That's it. People will pay for growth. If a company's in demand and they're growing very quickly, I'll just do a quick check of the figures here. We're on over 30 times EBITDA. We're on 42 times pretty much net profit, and over 11 times revenue. But it's a growing company, you know. They've come off a little bit. Like I said, what I'm worried on the chart is, I mean, it's a cracking company, but the first time ever in the last few weeks, they've had a lower high twice. That's not good because it's failing to achieve that previous high. I mean, it needs a bottom out here, maybe, and start turning around. But it's in my mind, right? I'm going to sort of do a shameless promotion here of a company that I own, and they're called Truefin. They're a holding company. They have a fintech company and a gaming company. They have four companies within them. One of them is called PlayStack. And they've got the same kind of thing, a funding model, a gaming arm. They've just had a big hit with Mortal Shell. It's a debut game that sold 500,000 units. It's been nominated for all kinds of awards. There's going to be a gaming Mortal Shell 2 probably. And because of that, their revenue doubled. But they've also got three other fintech companies. But PlayStack has the same tech as BidStack, and they've got a gaming arm as well. So they have it's 20-odd games, independent games being developed. And now, because of the success of Mortal Shell, of course, they can plough more money into getting more developers, more games out there, and so generating more cash. So all you need is that one big hit, you know, and then it helps the entire developing team develop more games. And that's, I think that PlayStack will be, I mean, this company is what, 70 million with 70 million market cap with these four different companies in it. I know Team 17 is close to a billion. So I think, to me, I would love to get into these, you know, like I said, when we, probably before we even first talked, when they 180, 180 a share, now they're 720. So, cracking business, absolutely. I wish it would roll over a bit, but if you're looking for a smaller company with a bit of gaming in it, then I think Truefin, TRU, is probably the one to look at. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. You raised a point about those two, two lower highs from post the results. Looking back to May last year, when the results came out last year, that almost exactly the same thing happened. So on 7th of May, shares were at 530p. Then they peaked at 590. Then they dropped off to 527p. So you had those two sort of lower highs last year, and then there was another one on 10th of July, 524. Since which time it started to climb again. So
different difference here though is there's the lower lows as well, and it wasn't back then. Pretty much they were flat, the lows. The lows they supported around £5 last time. Then it powered back up and it broke out in July. So if it's a good business, it'll be sustainable. We're not talking about a pop and drop resource stock here. Now, this is a company that will probably have a consolidation period and then climb back on because they're still growing. But it's becoming a £1 billion company now. So obviously the growth at which share price can rise will slow. Bigger companies move slower. And it's had phenomenal growth. The growth, from a couple of years ago. That's when to get in, wasn't it? IPO'd in the 23rd of May 2018.
That was the thing, that was the time really to get in. And I think during 2019 dipped below 2 quid a couple of times, 185. It was 185 in December, 181 in fact in December 2018. But since that time, it's just been top right hand corner stuff. And I just think this company will continue to grow. If you just look at the forward, the outlook statement from Debbie Bestwick, I mean, she's very bullish, but this lady's been at the helm for many years. And I think if there were, I get the impression she's very forthright and honest. And I think if there were issues, she'd tell shareholders. That's the way this company seems to be.
But I wouldn't buy the highs. Let's consolidate a bit. They've done very well, and they probably continue to do very well. But you've got to be aware of the size of the company now, because, like I said, as companies get bigger, they move more slowly. Elephants can charge actually, but. Saying comes from, but but mice are faster,
Mice are faster, and more agile.
If you're looking for, that's what you say. Once you get those prolific game studios that produce games non-stop, and they have one hit, and that snowballs into being able to plough more money into, employing more developers, more resources. You just need a hit, and with Truefin, PlayStack, Truefin owned PlayStack, one of the four companies they own. With that, they've got that one big hit already with Mortal Shell. And Mortal Shell 2, I didn't realise this, when you get... It's unlike films, the sequels in films can be a flop, and the first one is the best normal. It's the opposite way around with games. Because literally, you're starting off with no fan base. So if you get a hit on your first game, that's excellent, because then you've got an installed fan base, you know, and you get a better second game coming along, and you've got, like I said, already 500,000 people have played the first version. They're gagging at the bits, and they're chomping at the bit to get the next Mortal Shell 2, you know, the next iteration of that game. So the next one should be an even bigger hit. So more money going towards place, that and all that stuff. So, yeah, look forward to that. But Trufin, TRU's ticker for Team 17, TM17, you know, a success story there from IPO. Phenomenal. I wish you'd gone in on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Blazed a Trail. And sticking with gaming, coming to my next one now, and of course, again, we've spoken about this company on many occasions, and unfortunately, this company hasn't blazed the trail that we hope it would. Well, it's blazed a trail, but the wrong sort of trail. Bidstack, of course, BIDS. Now, I'm still a shareholder here because I took a decision. I'm sticking with the tech because I think this market is huge. The gaming marketplace is, as we know, vast. Reckon it's going to be some 260 billion by in 3 years' time. Some 3.5 billion gamers worldwide, and that's growing exponentially. So Bidstack, of course, developed a platform to serve live ads, dynamic ads, to these gamers in a gaming situation. And because the tech hadn't been was new, of course, they had to explore methods of validating the data they produced and also identifying people who were actually gaming rather than people that were just observing, so weren't really engaged. And to that end, they collaborated with Oracle and via a joint venture called Moat. They designed some technology to actually investigate the integrity and the validity of the data that was produced from the gaming traffic, and the results from that were very solid. Moat traffic validation announced in April this year with Dentsu D-Game Football Manager delivered over 99% GIVT, general invalid traffic free data, and that currently is 3.5 times better than industry. So we know Bidstack has a platform that works. It has technology that can be validated, which means what it can do is report accurate data back to advertisers that, of course, they can then resell. So there's no doubt. I mean, Bidstack has very strong momentum. It's added 14 new games to its network. It's partnering with Verizon and Verizon Media, and brand activations with Bidstack are now being recognized across major global campaigns in fashion and beauty, and also with major agencies. And for example, Publicis, Starcom, their Paco Rabanne campaign that was used to reach young men who were gaming, and that was a very successful campaign. We've also seen of course, Bidstack has appointed a very strong advisory board, and these are senior figures and well-regarded figures in the gaming industry that have been on hand to provide advice and to help the company through its various stages to evolution. The latest in that regard is a gentleman called Glenn Calvert, but Glenn actually stepped up from the advisory board and became a non-exec director. And Glenn runs a company called Fnatic, which is involved in artificial intelligence, and he is there to help propel Bidstack to the next level. Lisa Howell, Chief Ops Officer, also joined the board, and Lisa's formerly WPP Investor Relations, so she, I think, is going to manage the comms with the markets going forward, which is probably a good thing given the false starts that Bidstack has had over the years. And the company said that Bidstack is steadily transitioning rapidly to the next phase of scalable growth, and that's being embedded in campaigns. But of course, it seems that every time Bidstack puts some news out, there are detractors on hand to point out that the company management have not managed the company effectively. And I think, to a large extent, there is truth in that. You know, I think comms have been poor, but for me, it's not about management. It's about whether the quality of the product will come through in the end and make an impact in the sector, because it's a huge sector. You know, 256 billion marketplace in 3 years' time gives you some idea of the scalability and the opportunities that that provides for advertisers. And Bidstack have the platform to do it. There's no doubt about that. What is holding the share price at 4p at the moment is the fact that they did the last fundraise they did was at 4.2p. And I still hold shares in from that level. So I'm happy to sit on those and take a view on the future. And of course, the shares have dipped below 4p. It gives Bidstack a market cap of 16.6 billion, 16.6 million, which is, you know, frankly, in this day and age of technology companies, if this company were listed on the NASDAQ, I believe it would be 10 times that. And that's,
yeah, but it's
that's
not. Just,
but it's not. And that's just my view. But I think the reason it isn't is because of the way the comms to the retail investor and institutional investors has been managed by the company to date. And it's quite simply that. I think the technology is there. The, you know, the fact that these people are getting involved with the company, the fact that Glenn Calvert has stepped up as a non-exec director, that to me is highly significant. You know, senior people in the industry want to be involved with this company. So I'm looking past the current board and looking at what's happening behind the scenes, and I do believe this company still has a very strong future. And also, there are rumours that a fundraise is going to be needed very shortly. We've not seen it yet. Could well be the case. But it also might be the case that the growth in revenues that Bidstack have been starting to deliver could still be growing. So they, if the revenues are growing strongly, then it will either push back or in extreme circumstances negate any future need or requirements to raise further money.
No, if you look at the cash they're burning, I mean, there seems to be a gap there. So there's that, fundraising. I mean, If it is the fundraise or rumours of it that's pushing the price down, they need to come out and say we don't need a fundraise, but they haven't done that. So
this is the thing. This is my beef with the company, and you know, I'm speaking as a shareholder.
Let me say one thing though. The thing they haven't done, and I was a big fan of Bidstack. I really promoted them because I held stock, and they missed revenue. Of course, the cutting edge tech, so nothing runs smoothly, and they didn't monetize that tech. They had problems monetizing it as quickly as they thought they would. They missed their targets, and so of course missed expectations. But, you know, people jump out and think, hang on, they come into the market with around about 6 million target, and I thought that was amazing for new tech, and they did nowhere near that. And so that's the problem. That, you know, the revenue generation has been promised, but it hasn't materialized as yet. And now there's rumors, like you said, people keep saying they need a fundraise, and judging by the cash burn, they probably do. So it's a vicious circle, but I still like the tech. But do you know what? They're not alone now. Like I said, do you know what I mentioned just then? PlayStack. PlayStack have the same tech, but they can put it in their own games because they've also got a suite of games. So there's companies like, and if you look at Truefin, the holder of these four companies, they're only valued at 70 million. They've got over 15 million in cash, and now you split these four companies up, and that's what, that 65 divided by four. What's that, 12 million each they valued at?
Yep.
And it's Cartago, one of the companies, is doing a deal with Lloyd's for their systems, and they're all starting to break even now and start to generate cash. So, I think Truefin's undervalued because they've got all that tech as well and it's monetizing it. It's due a bounce. I think once they get to, if they need to get a fundraise, if they need to do a fundraise, and once they get that, it should bounce, I think. But
I also think the comms have to be better with investors. I mean, they need to talk. James
is a good talker. He's a good talker. The trouble is, he's living the dream, living the vision. I mean, and he expresses the vision and the dream, but then the dream takes a long time to materialize. That's the trouble.
I think if not James Draper, then Lisa Howe. You know, she's chief ops officer now. Maybe she's the one that should be talking in interviews, interviewed by, Vox, Proactive, or whoever, and, actually talk to investors about what's happening with the company. Because I think that's needed right now. And the silence from the board in that regard is shouldn't be happening.
If they come out now and say, if they say a fundraise is not needed, they'd come out and say it. Now, if their fundraiser is needed, they're not going to come out and say a fundraiser is needed, are they? Because it's just going to push the price down. People are going to worry about the discount. So they're in a really a rock and hard place at the moment, aren't they? So, I think they just have to wait and get the fundraiser out of the way. If they're doing a fundraiser, they have to get out of the way, and then move on.
Yeah, if they're doing it, and if they are doing it, then they need to perhaps they need to get it out of the way. But they, regardless, they need to talk about the market, about what's happening. They need to provide a trading update, and I think they've got to get someone else other than James Draper in to do that. You know, James Draper, to my mind, is more of a chief ops officer. You know, he should be the guy driving the tech and building the tech, and there should be a spokesperson that knows how to communicate with the markets, actually talking to the markets via all the channels that we use, and that's not happening at the moment. So
we've got time. I've got someone on now. Can you do a minute talk on the last company, or should we save it for next week?
Save it for next week. Yeah, okay. That's right.
Marvelous stuff. Cheers for that, Al, and have a nice weekend. It's gonna be a sunny one. Get your shorts on. Get something on anyway, and get the barbecue out, because you don't want to burn your bits on the barbecue, so get the shorts on. Cheers, Al. I'll speak to you next week.
I'll send you a picture.
Please don't.
Okay,
it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five: Mode Global Holdings, up 2.13% to 48 pence. At four: Biome Technologies. It's up 6.4% to 4.15. At three, Challenger Energy, non-move at 0.305. At two, Quantum Blockchain, down 7.6% to 1.825. And at one, Hummingbird Resources, up just over 1% to 22.6%. Good news out on those today. Okay, it's time for the top five most viewed RNSs. And they are today. Let's check them out. It's five, Tuple, new contracts. At four, Helium 1, exercise of warrants and issue of equity. At three, Hemogenics, that's holdings and company. At two, Velix, KTH 222 evaluation agreement concluded. And at one, Ascent Resources, Slovenia claim funding update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.